hour's reading of Sports Today. A 1 hour reading of sports news from 7 to 8 p.m. every Tuesday and Thursday. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Let's begin today's reading with a feature that's entitled Rob Manfred's Letter to Pete Rose's Attorney. And this feature written by Gabe Lackis of USA Today. For Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred, the word dead is as good as the word permanent. At least that's the reasoning that he cited on May 13th in removing Pete Rose from the permanently ineligible list 7 months after the all-time hit leader's death at age 83. It was a startling end to a 36-year ban after Rose wagered on games both as Cincinnati Reds manager and as a player. While the agreement that he signed with then-Commissioner A. Bartlett Giamatti in agreeing to the lifetime ban stipulated that Rose did not admit to betting on baseball, he ultimately copped to placing wagers on the Reds in a 2004 biography. Manfred wrote a letter explaining the posthumously lifting of the permanently ineligible status to Rose's attorney, Jeffrey M. Lenkoff. Lenkoff met with Manfred in January in the latest bid to restore Rose's status in the game. The reinstatement effort gained considerable steam when President Donald Trump urged Rose to be eligible for the Hall of Fame in a February 28th social media post. Here is the full text of Manfred's letter that was released by Major League Baseball. Quote, Dear Mr. Lenkoff, I write in response to your letter on behalf of the Rose family on January 8, 2025, and the request contained therein that Pete Rose be posthumously removed from the permanently ineligible list. As you know, I denied a prior request for reinstatement from Mr. Rose in the year 2015. In my view, the only salient fact that has changed since that decision is that Mr. Rose has recently passed away. The question of whether an individual should remain on the permanently ineligible list after his death has never been formally addressed by Major League Baseball. Indeed, Mr. Rose is the first person banned by a commissioner other than Kennesaw Mountain Landis to die while still on the ineligible list. As such, it is incumbent upon the Office of the Commissioner to reach a policy decision regarding this unprecedented issue in the modern era. The phrase lifetime ban has often been used to describe the punishment agreed to by Mr. Rose and the Office of the Commissioner. However, the use of that phrase is not accurate. In fact, the 1989 agreement between Mr. Rose and the Office of the Commissioner tracks the actual language of Rule 21, and Mr. Rose was placed on the permanently ineligible list referenced in Rule 21. In my view, a determination must be made regarding how the phrase permanently ineligible should be interpreted in light of the purposes and policies behind Rule 21. In my decision on Mr. Rose's last request for reinstatement, I set forth the following standard for deciding that request. I, as Commissioner of Baseball, must determine the risk that Mr. Rose will commit a violation of Major League Baseball's rules following his reinstatement that may impact the integrity of the game. I went on to say, while the commissioner is afforded certain discretion in considering an application under Major League Rule Number 15D for reinstatement from the permanently ineligible list, the commissioner must exercise that discretion with great care, bearing in mind the intended deterrent effect for the mandatory penalty for a violation of Rule 21 and the best interests of baseball. Taken together, these comments make clear that penalties imposed under Rule 21 are intended to 1. Protect the game from individuals who pose a risk to the integrity of the sport by prohibiting the participation of such individuals, and 2. Create a deterrent effect that reduces the likelihood of future violations by others. In my view, once an individual has passed away, the purposes of Rule 21 have been served. Obviously, a person no longer with us cannot represent a threat to the integrity of the game. Moreover, it is hard to conceive of a penalty that has more deterrent effect than one that lasts a lifetime with no reprieve. Therefore, I have concluded that permanent ineligibility ends upon the passing of the disciplined individual, and Mr. Rose will be removed from the permanently ineligible list. While it is my preference not to disturb decisions made by prior commissioners, Mr. Rose was not placed on the permanently ineligible list by commissioner action, but rather as the result of a 1989 settlement of potential litigation with the commissioner's office. My decision today is consistent with Commissioner Giamatti's expectations of that agreement. In the press conference announcing the settlement with Mr. Rose, Commissioner Giamatti answered a question about the effect of the settlement on Mr. Rose's potential election to the Hall of Fame. Commissioner Giamatti's comments were completely reasonable given that at the time the Hall of Fame did not have a rule barring people on the permanently ineligible list from Hall of Fame consideration. In fact, Shoeless Joe Jackson was afforded the opportunity to be voted upon in 1936 and again in 1946. In closing, I want to emphasize that it is not part of my responsibility or authority to express any view concerning Mr. Rose's consideration by or possible election to the Hall of Fame. I agree with Commissioner Giamatti that responsibility for that decision lies with the Hall of Fame. Sincerely, Robert D. Manfred, Jr. And the next headline reads, Pete Rose's path to the Hall of Fame is neither simple nor quick. This feature also written by Gabe Lackus of USA Today. Pete Rose is, somewhat stunningly, off Major League Baseball's permanently ineligible list. But that doesn't mean that he is automatically in the Hall of Fame. Casual baseball fans often equated Rose's ban, which lasted past his September 2024 death until Commissioner Rob Manfred reinstated him on May 13th, with a banishment from Cooperstown's shrine. But reinstatement doesn't ensure enshrinement. Certainly, Hall of Fame officials deferred to Major League Baseball with regard to Rose's eligibility, a procedural choice that kept their hands out of the quagmire for decades. Yet with Rose now eligible, when might fans, unbothered by his many indiscretions, see the slap-hitting scourge have his day in Cooperstown? According to hall regulations, Rose's candidacy won't come up for a couple of years. As a player whose greatest contributions to the game came before the year 1980, he will be under consideration by the 12-person Classic Baseball Committee, a group that also considers candidates from the Negro Leagues and pre-Negro League stars. The group will next vote in December of 2027 for induction in July of 2028. While Rose broke Ty Cobb's all-time hits record in 1985, he played 17 of his 24 seasons before 1980, amassing 3,372 of his 4,256 hits in that span. That puts him in the same bucket as players like Dave Parker, who debuted 10 years after Rose in 1973 and played until 1991, and was elected by the Classic Baseball Committee for enshrinement in July. The 2027 ballot for the Classic Baseball Era Committee will be determined by the Historical Overview Committee, a group of 10 baseball historians appointed by the Baseball Writers Association. That group includes 8 current or former baseball writers, a university professor, and a statistician. Last year, the committee included Parker, fellow electee Dick Allen, Tommy John, Ken Boyer, John Donaldson, Steve Garvey, Vic Harris, and Luis Tiant on the Classic Baseball ballot. Should the committee include Rose in the group of 8 Classic-era finalists, his candidacy will be voted on by a 16-member electorate. In 2024, that group was comprised of Hall of Famers Paul Molitor, Joe Torre, Lee Smith, Tony Perez, Eddie Murray, and Ozzie Smith, along with Angels owner Artie Marino, 4 other baseball executives, and 5 baseball writers and historians. The committee was chaired by Hall of Fame Chairman of the Board, Jane Forbes Clark. Clark and the Hall managed to keep a distance from the emotional Rose issue, deferring over the decades to whomever sat in the commissioner's chair. In a statement May 13th, Clark said that the Hall is prepared to consider Rose's case. Quote, "The National Baseball Hall of Fame has always maintained that anyone removed from baseball's permanently ineligible list will become eligible for Hall of Fame consideration." Major League Baseball's decision to remove deceased individuals from the permanently ineligible list will allow the Hall of Fame candidacy of such individuals to now be considered. The Historical Overview Committee will develop the ballot of 8 names for the Classic Baseball Era Committee, which evaluates candidates who made their greatest impact on the game prior to 1980, to vote on when it meets next in December of 2027, unquote. Not necessarily. Like the Hall voting done by hundreds of BBWWA members, Rose would need to garner support on 75% of ballots, or 12 of the 16 committee members. In what surely became an ongoing measuring stick of perceived moral turpitude, all-time home run king Barry Bonds failed to reach that plateau in his first year under Contemporary Era Committee review in 2022. Bonds received less than 4 votes, the Hall announced, meeting the same fate as Roger Clemens and Rafael Palmeiro, two other players closely tied to performance-enhancing drug use. While Rose is the all-time hits king, Bonds is the objectively superior player, amassing 162.8 career WAR to Rose's 79.6. Future committees will face the same ethical quandary that BBWAA voters did in the decade that Bonds, Clemens, and others were on the Hall ballot. Is gambling on games that you managed and likely played in a disqualifying violation? For decades, Major League Baseball commissioners upholding Rose's permanent ban made that a non-issue. In coming years, it will be in the hands of 16 electors. And again, that feature entitled Pete Rose's Path to the Hall of Fame is Neither Simple Nor Quick, written by Gabe Lacaz of USA Today. And in another feature on the Pete Rose issue, this one's entitled Rose's Family is Elated with Major League Baseball Reinstatement. This feature, written by Gordon Wittenmeyer of the Cincinnati Inquirer. The park in the Sedumsville neighborhood already had been known as Pete Rose Park for nearly as long as Cincinnati's first son of baseball had become a fixture in the Big Red Machine lineup. It's where Rose's father, Harry Francis Pete Rose, played smash-mouth football into middle age, once running down an opponent for a game-saving tackle after breaking his hip during the game, according to family legend. Tin and wooden signs have come and gone at the ball field at Boldface Park, but the identity of the place is rooted in decades of civic pride and history. That's the thing, Pete Rose Jr. said. If you say Boldface, or if you say Pete Rose Park, if you're from this way, over from the city, you know exactly where you're going, unquote. So when the Cincinnati Reds and local officials partnered to dedicate the spot on May 14th with the presentation of a new permanent marker on the day that Reds celebrated Pete Rose Day, it was more symbolic than substance, more past than prologue. Besides, what mattered most to Rose's family and friends on this day is what the past day meant for the next 3 years. It is great, Rose Jr. said, just to have the opportunity. All you could say is, you're nothing but thrilled, unquote. Rose Jr.'s older sister, Fawn Rose, shed tears when she got the phone call on May 13th while boarding a plane in Seattle, where she lives, for the events in Cincinnati honoring her father. I think my kids thought somebody had died, she said. Her 5-month effort to have her father's permanent ban from baseball lifted by Commissioner Bob Manfred was made official 36 years after Rose was banned and 7.5 months after his death. I just wish that he were here to be able to celebrate with the fans, Fawn Rose said. He always would get excited when he was coming in to do something or to talk to people. I was just asked whether I ever get sick and tired of hearing stories from fans, she said. And I don't, because each story is different, because it shows that my dad took the time to listen and he remembers. Each story was real, and every time I hear somebody say something, I'm like, yeah, I'm really proud that I'm his kid because he really did care about his fans, unquote. Pete Rose took both of his oldest kids, Fawn and Pete Jr., to play at that ballpark in Boldface Park when they were kids, and the rainy, mournful weather played across the green of the upbeat ceremony. Brutal, Pete Jr. said when considering that the lifting of his father's ban came as an almost inevitably posthumous action. That's the thing. They made a decision which was great, but it's not going to bring Dad back. It's the human element part to where I'm still processing not having a dad. It's not even been a year yet, he said. I understand what kind of magnitude, what kind of player he was, but we're talking about Dad, and that's the hardest thing, unquote. That doesn't mean that Manfred's decision wasn't profoundly meaningful to Rose's family, despite the circumstances. I think he's probably smiling down, knowing that his grandkids and his kids are here and what it means to us, because it is our legacy, Fawn Rose said, and we're very proud of who he is. Whatever comes next, Rose Jr. won't speculate on his dad's chances for Hall of Fame induction. He says he's not even sure how it works. Fawn Rose said that her meeting with Manfred in December and petition in January was as far as the family planned to pursue reinstatement. If the commissioner's decision would have been to deny the petition, then I think that we would have let it go, she said. I'm happy the way it turned out, unquote. And again, that feature entitled Rose's Family is Elated with Major League Baseball Reinstatement, written by Gordon Wittenmeyer of the Cincinnati Enquirer. And one more Pete Rose feature, this one also coming from the Cincinnati Enquirer. The headline reads, Mike Schmidt, quote, there's always the issue of Pete Rose off the field, unquote. Mike Schmidt, a teammate of Pete Rose's with the Philadelphia Phillies from 1979 to 1983, has been among the Cincinnati Reds legend's most vocal supporters among National Baseball Hall of Famers throughout the years. But Schmidt said that there will always be a quote-unquote cloud when it comes to Rose's Hall of Fame candidacy, even after Rose was among players removed last week by Commissioner Rob Manfred from its permanently ineligible list. Quote, I think the Pete Rose question is always going to be divided, 50-50, Schmidt said. Even in terms of the Hall of Fame, I think if you pose the question to all of the living Hall of Famers right now, I think it would almost be 50-50. That's my guess. I don't have any hardcore feelings on either side. I see both sides. I see that he squandered so many opportunities to change his life and go forward and do what Commissioner Bud Selig asked him to do in a then-secret 2002 meeting arranged by Schmidt and Joe Morgan. There wasn't remorse there, Schmidt added. He didn't show any atonement for his admission to betting on baseball. But at the same time, Pete Rose is one of the greatest players in the history of baseball, without question. Statistically and for what he did in his career, it would be a unanimous Hall of Famer, unquote. Schmidt was asked whether he thinks that committee members will be able to just vote on Rose, the baseball player. Absolutely not, Schmidt said. Nope, I don't think that can happen. Let me just say no to that. There is a cloud. There's always going to be a cloud. There's always going to be the issue of Pete Rose off the field. You could debate this until you're blue in the face, and it's really hard to find a pat answer to this. It's very difficult. I've never really found one myself in the thousands of times I've been asked this question, unquote. Mike Schmidt issued the following statement after the announcement, quote, "It's a great day for baseball as Commissioner Manfred has reinstated Pete Rose, making him eligible for the National Baseball Hall of Fame. The ongoing question of whether Pete Rose should or shouldn't be in the hall will be answered by a select panel in the next Classic Baseball Era Committee. Congratulations to Pete's family, his teammates, as well as his supporters who have waited many years for this opportunity for consideration," unquote. And in one more baseball feature related to this topic, the headline reads, "Who was Shoeless Joe Jackson? Stats and Career of a Legend." And this feature written by Austin Curtwright and Jim Reisenking of USA Today. Shoeless Joe Jackson and Pete Rose were two of 17 deceased individuals reinstated by Major League Baseball, as Commissioner Rob Manfred noted its punishment of banned players ends upon their death. The two were previously viewed as stains on the game based on their gambling participation during their playing careers. Jackson was banned from baseball in 1921, along with seven other Chicago White Sox players, for fixing the 1919 World Series. Jackson ranks fourth in Major League history in batting average. His lifetime batting average was .356. Jackson was a Major League outfielder from 1908 to 1920, but was most known for his time with the White Sox. He won the 1917 World Series with Chicago, but was also part of one of Major League Baseball's most well-known controversies. Jackson played 12 Major League seasons, primarily in the outfield. He was one of the best contact hitters ever, with a career line of .356 batting average and .517 slugging percentage. His best seasons came with Cleveland from 1910 to 1915, and he also played for the Philadelphia Athletics from 1908 to 1909, and the White Sox from 1915 to 1920. Jackson is also a notable character in the baseball movie Field of Dreams, and was depicted by actor Ray Liotta. Why was Jackson banned? Jackson, along with seven teammates, was banned from Major League Baseball after the 1920 season for attempting to fix the 1919 World Series. The players were accused of accepting $5,000 each to purposely lose the series. The White Sox players were actually acquitted by a Chicago jury, but were banned from Major League Baseball anyway by the league's first commissioner, Kennesaw Mountain Landis. Jackson had 12 hits in the series, a record that was not broken until 1964. He also was not charged with an error. Here are Jackson's career stats in 12 Major League seasons. For his career, he had a 62.2 WAR, 1,772 hits, and 54 home runs, 873 runs, 792 RBIs, and 202 stolen bases, a .356 lifetime batting average, and .423 on-base percentage, and a .517 slugging percentage. And among the total 17 reinstated individuals, first, of course, comes Pete Rose, who is the all-time hits leader, permanently banned in 1989. Then there are the Black Sox, eight members of the Chicago White Sox who were permanently suspended by Commissioner Kennesaw Mountain Landis in 1921 for conspiring with gamblers to throw the 1919 World Series to the Cincinnati Reds. Those players were pitchers Eddie Cacciotti and Lefty Williams, outfielder Happy Felsch, first baseman Chick Gandel, shortstop Swade Risberg, third baseman Buck Weaver, utility infielder Fred McMullen, and Shoeless Joe Jackson, one of the greatest hitters in baseball history. Next banned player who was reinstated, Joe Gideon, a member of the St. Louis Browns at the time of the Black Sox scandal. Gideon was present during meetings between gamblers and the aforementioned White Sox players. Then there's Gene Paulette. Once the Black Sox scandal ruling was made by Commissioner Landis, Paulette was retroactively suspended permanently from the game for allegedly receiving gifts from gamblers to throw games while playing for the Philadelphia Phillies. Another player banned was Benny Koff, banned by Landis despite being acquitted by a jury for allegedly stealing a car. It seems that Landis, a former judge, had made up his mind, despite the jury's decision, that Koff was guilty. Next, there was Lee McGee. McGee and the notorious Hal Chase, who was a fine baseball player in his own right, but also had a reputation for allegedly conspiring with gamblers, were accused of throwing a game while McGee's Chicago Cubs played Chase's Philadelphia Phillies. It should be noted that Chase was not among the 17 individuals reinstated by Manfred. Then there was Phil Douglas. Landis permanently suspended Douglas for writing a letter offering to desert his New York Giants due to quarrels with feisty manager John McGraw, and hurt his team's pennant-winning chances in the 1922 season. Then there's Jimmy O'Connell. While playing for the Giants in 1924, O'Connell offered an opposing player $500 to throw games in order to help his Giants win the pennant. Then there's Cozy Dolan. Dolan was a coach on O'Connell's Giants and also was suspended as part of O'Connell's attempt to bribe a Phillies player to throw games. And finally, there was William Cox. Cox's tenure as owner of the Phillies was brief. After buying the team in March of 1943, Cox was indefinitely suspended by Kennesaw Mountain Landis in November of 1943 for placing bets on his own team. And again, that feature entitled Who Was Shoeless Joe Jackson? Written by Austin Curtwright and Jim Reineking of USA Today. And from baseball news, let's turn now to some football news. The next headline reads, College football must address the NFL's threat to its playoff schedule. This feature written by Matt Hayes of USA Today Sports. We're not seeing the big picture here. We're slogging through the minutiae of the college football postseason instead of dealing with the big bad shield in the room, the NFL shield. So while college football's power brokers are busy arguing straight seeding, first-round buys, campus sites, and who will choose the expected 16-team college football playoff field, they are ignoring the greatest threat to the ever-evolving system that decided a national champion. The NFL's television schedule structure is in direct competition with the college football playoff. That means decreased ratings and decreased growth for a sport trying to develop a new postseason format. This season alone, critical decision matchups between the Philadelphia Eagles and Washington Commanders and Green Bay Packers and Chicago Bears fall on the same Saturday as three first-round games. No matter how important or intriguing those first-round college football playoff matchups prove to be, they will be dwarfed by critical December NFL games, just like last year's three first-round games in the same window. And lost television ratings and growth means lost millions from future media rights deals, the very reason that university presidents blew up the original four-team CFP in the first place. My hope is that there are ways around it, said Florida State Athletic Director Mike Alford. Yeah, well, hope is not a plan. Leverage is. I've said it over and over and will say it again. College football has leverage on the NFL. College football is the free minor league system for the NFL. If the NFL wants to keep benefiting from that free system, I don't think that this can be underscored enough, free. It's time to treat college football as a partner, not like old gum on the bottom of the NFL sneaker. There was a time not long ago that college football decided to play games on Thursday night, a unique idea that ESPN turned into a cult following. Sure enough, the NFL saw the success and large television ratings and commandeered the night. NFL Thursday night games now dwarf the college football games, so much so that college football has all but given up on big power conference games and now feeds Thursday night with a steady diet of meaningless Group of Five games. 2 years ago, the NFL sold Thursday night games as a standalone media rights package to Amazon and now makes $1 billion annually from it. Yep, $1 billion. That's lost revenue for college football, a sport searching for cash streams while dealing with looming revenue sharing with players. By proxy, it means lost revenue for college sports, which is dealing with a potential loss of Olympic sports teams, both men and women, because cash to support those teams is now used to pay players in revenue-producing sports like football and basketball. Yet, here we are, deep into the process of what the new playoff format will look like, and we cannot see the forest for the shield. The problem isn't the format, the problem is the NFL. You know, the same NFL receiving free player development, again, free, from college football year after year after year. Anyone else find it odd that college football is swimming in a paradigm change over the last four seasons, in danger of the whole thing falling apart, while the NFL has been eerily quiet about the entire mess? Hasn't offered support, hasn't reached out to say, hey, since you've given us free player development from the time our game was invented, maybe we can hop off the Saturday of your first-round games. Maybe we can avoid future scheduling conflicts and work with college football to grow the postseason instead of ignoring it. But the NFL has no reason to acquiesce. If college football continues to provide game and practice tape whenever the NFL asks, if it continues to allow access to practice and games and everyone involved in player development during the NFL draft process, why would the NFL change anything? There are two ways to make the NFL move off its mark: affect its money or player procurement. Here, everyone is where college football has leverage. The NFL wants every piece of information possible on players that it drafts, performing its due diligence to avoid multi-million dollar mistakes on investments. The NCAA or College Football Playoff Committee, Board of Directors, or whoever's running the damn sport at this point, should send a letter to all 32 NFL teams. No more practice and game access to all FBS and FCS teams. No more game and practice tape. No more access to coaches and assistant coaches or anyone else connected to players until the NFL eliminates scheduling conflicts with the CFP. It's not a big ask, and frankly, there shouldn't have to be a threat. There should be someone within college football. I nominate Nick Saban, even though he doesn't want the job, who can call NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell and speak hard truths. The NFL isn't your friend. It's the greatest threat to college football's postseason. Do something about it. And again, that feature entitled, College Football Must Address NFL's Threat to Its Playoff Schedule, written by Matt Hayes of USA Today. And from football news, let's turn now to some horse racing news. Headline reads, Great Preakness Exposes Horse Racing's Failures. This feature written by Dan Wolken, columnist for USA Today. In a few weeks, they're going to start tearing down what is left of Old Pimlico, an historic racetrack that has been rotting in the middle of Baltimore for decades, revived year after year only for one reason. When you have the middle jewel of horse racing's Triple Crown, you do whatever you can not to lose it. As Journalism won the 150th edition of the Preakness on May the 17th, surviving one of the most rough-and-tumble stretch runs you'll ever see and coming back from what seemed like an impossible position with an eighth of a mile to go, you can understand why Maryland is about to invest $400 million to give the place the facelift that it deserves. Yes, even in a fractured sport that struggles to gain mainstream interest outside of 5 weeks every year, the Preakness still matters, and Maryland lawmakers have put huge stakes on the table to keep it. But that investment isn't going to pay off unless horse racing gets its act together. As thrilling as the race was, and as great of a horse as journalism appears to be, did anyone but the sport's dwindling diehards care? The answer, of course, is not really. The moment Kentucky Derby winner Sovereignty was withdrawn from consideration for the Preakness, the race was essentially rendered meaningless in the greater sports landscape. And it didn't have to be that way. In the old days, a rematch between Sovereignty and Journalism, who ran eyeball to eyeball in the Derby until the former pulled ahead in the stretch, would have been worth at least a few headlines over the next couple weeks. Instead, Sovereignty's connections decided that coming back 2 weeks after the Derby, which is almost unheard of at any level of horse racing these days, was not a good fit for their horse. We will see him again on June the 7th at the Belmont Stakes, rested and ready. With the Preakness field coming up pretty weak, journalism trainer Michael McCarthy threw his hat in the ring and got rewarded with a victory in a $2 million race. But given the two hard races he already has under his belt, the odds of bringing journalism to New York for a rematch are low. Maybe they'll meet again in late August at the Traverse Stakes, known in racing as the Midsummer Derby, or the season-ending Breeders' Cup Classic. It is possible that the Derby will end up being their only meeting. And given the way that this Triple Crown has played out through two races, we'll always wonder, what if? What a blown opportunity for a sport that could use the kind of rivalry that we used to see all the time, whether it was Affirmed and Aladar or Sunday Silence and Easygoer. The best raced against the best in the biggest races over and over again. The horses had actual fan bases who showed up at the track. The owners and the trainers often did not like each other. And it was awesome for horse racing and for the broadcasters and for the bettors and casual fans who just wanted to tune in for some human and equine drama. Can it ever get back to that? Not the way the Triple Crown is structured these days. The problem with changing anything about the Triple Crown is that Churchill Downs, Pimlico, and the New York Horse Racing Association all operate as separate entities. If you want to move the Preakness 2 weeks later, well, you need to get Belmont officials first to move their race later in the calendar, too. That's not so easy when everyone has their own piece of real estate. But the most powerful people in horse racing need to understand one thing. It is to the benefit of everyone if the best horses run in all three legs of the Triple Crown. And it is especially crucial to Maryland, which is about to start this massive construction project on the premise that the Preakness is going to attract the Derby winner every single year, barring injury. Unless that happens, Maryland has wasted its time and money. And it's not so good for Belmont's piece of the pie either, if there's almost never going to be a chance for a Triple Crown winner, or at least a sustained rivalry on its biggest day. As Pimlico closes its doors and moves the Preakness about 15 miles south to Laurel Park for a couple of years, all the relevant entities need to get in a room and decide what is best for the future and for horse racing. Because even a great race and a great horse doesn't do much to keep your sport relevant when there is no overarching story to tell. That's just basic journalism. And again, that feature entitled Great Preakness Exposes Horse Racing's Failures, written by Dan Wolkin, columnist for USA Today. And aside from this feature, there's another one that is summing up the past Preakness running. Headline reads, Journalism Rallies Down the Stretch to Edge Gosker, written by James Story and Jason Frakis of the Louisville Courier-Journal. Kentucky Derby runner-up Journalism won the 150th Preakness Stakes on May 17th in Baltimore, crossing the finish line in 1 minute 55.47 seconds in the 1 3/16 mile second leg of the Triple Crown. He had to overcome a significant deficit in the final stretch to edge Gosker at the finish line. Journalism was saddled by trainer Michael McCarthy, and Umberto Rispoli was the winning jockey. A lot of bouncing around there looked like coming to the 3/16th or wherever it was. I guess when I saw that, I kind of resigned myself to the fact that it was another fantastic effort. Maybe come up a bit short, but just goes to show the testament that this horse has, McCarthy told NBC. At one point, Journalism was sandwiched between Clever Again and Goal-Oriented, where he exchanged bumps before breaking free. The last Triple Crown leg is the Belmont Stakes on June the 7th at Saratoga Racecourse in Saratoga Springs, New York. And from horse racing news, let's move now to WNBA news, starting with the Atlanta Dream Team, a new coach and front court. It's been 7 years since Atlanta had a winning season. The Dream hired Carl Smesko as head coach and got two veterans in Brittany Griner and Breonna Jones. The two experienced centers not only bring size to Atlanta, but much-needed leadership in a new regime. Ryan Howard is the franchise center stone, and she will greatly benefit from the additions. The Dream should make the postseason, and the playoff experience from Griner and Jones could be critical. Then there's the Chicago Sky. The top priority for Chicago was to get some premier talent at the guard position. The Sky did that by bringing back Courtney Vandersloot after she won the title with New York last season, plus the additions of Ariel Atkins, Rebecca Allen, and Kia Nurse. All the veterans will serve as great teachers for Haley Van Lith as she reunites with Reese. Then there's the Connecticut Sun. The Sun don't retain any starters from the core that made the team a title threat the past three seasons. New coach Rashid Razini has his work cut out for him as he tries to find something to build with in what will likely be a very difficult season. The rookies in Anissa Morrow and Sania Rivers are potentially pieces to build around in the coming years. Next, we look at the Dallas Wings. The attention will be on Paige Bueckers as the top pick in the 2025 draft. The additions of DeJoni Carrington and Alyssa Smith, plus with Arike Agbawale still on the roster, should make Dallas a possible playoff team, and Bueckers will be expected to make an immediate impact. Next, we look at the Indiana Fever, where Clark gets new weapons. Stephanie White is now in charge, and with players like Dawana Bonner and Sydney Colson, the expectations have been significantly raised for the Fever. Next, we look at the Las Vegas Aces. The Aces were denied a three-peat, and it left a bad taste in the organization's mouth. Despite the quote-unquote down year, Wilson proved why she is among the best players in the world with a career season. Trying to capitalize on its stars window, Las Vegas got Jewel Lloyd from Seattle. A two-time champion, Lloyd should become an explosive guard who can help take the pressure off Wilson and get Las Vegas back into the championship conversation. And then there's the Phoenix Mercury. The Diana Taurasi era is over and Griner is gone, but Phoenix was very active by adding an MVP-caliber player in Alyssa Thomas. To make it even sweeter, the team added Satu Sabali to give it one of the best front courts in the league. Kalia Copper remains after a very successful 2024 campaign, and the Mercury should remain a playoff contender. And finally, for the New York Liberty, defending champs positioned for a repeat. The Liberty finally reached the mountaintop of the league, and they have everything to win it all again. Brianna Stewart, Sabrina Ionescu, and Jonquel Jones all remain in their prime, and the front office made sure to stay loaded with the addition of Natasha Cloud. Every team will be vying to beat New York, which will be a tough task for the rest of the league. And that's all the time that we have for this edition of Sports Today. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Have a great evening. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info. And you could hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.